Case number 14-1268, State of Kansas et al. Petitioners v. Environmental Protection Agency and Gina McCarthy. Mr. Gustafson for the petitioners, Mr. Heminger for the respondents.
Good morning, Judge Millett. May it please the Court. Adam Gustafson for the states of Kansas and Nebraska and other petitioners. I'm joined by Chief Deputy Attorney General Jeff Cheney of Kansas and by James Conde. The states are presumptively required to use EPA's fundamentally flawed model, even though the erroneous vehicular emissions estimates, based on a study designed by Chevron, will delay compliance with the air quality standards. That's a recognized injury for standing purposes. Because the official release is binding on its face, EPA was required to give notice and an opportunity for
comment. It's only binding for someone who's in non-attainment, correct? Does it apply, if there hadn't been new ozone regulations, would it apply to Kansas at all? Would you have anything?
Well, as a matter of fact, the states are required to provide inputs to the MOVES model to EPA under a separate regulation raised in the EPA's brief.
Well, I assume you don't have any problem providing inputs on your views on that model.
No, I'm sorry. The inputs, the data inputs that go into the model.
Mm-hmm.
So in some respects, the model is already applicable. But the question in this case is whether the injury here is imminent. And here, every link in the chain of causation is undeniable. So the states are already out of compliance with the ozone max. That's in the declarations. And that's measured by monitors in those states. And so by operation of law, those states will have to be designated as non-attainment, and they will have to submit state implementation plans by operation of law after being
designated. Is there any discretion at all for the designation?
No, there's no discretion at all. So this is unlike the Clapper case where you have attenuated chain of causation with discretionary judgments at each step in the process. Here, there is no room for discretion. And EPA doesn't deny that the states exceed the 70 parts per billion levels allowed by the ozone act.
Can you clarify one thing? The if you have to do a state implementation plan, you will also have to do a transportation conformity analysis. Is that mandatory?
Yes, that's mandatory.
And that's for any determination of non-attainment?
Right. So once
Mr. Brunetti had said something about moderate non-attainment in his declaration, and I wasn't sure why he had that adjective.
There are different categories of non-attainment, but for our purposes, there's no difference. Once you are not in attainment, you have to do a state implementation plan, and you have to do conformity analysis to demonstrate that any new projects are not going to take you out of compliance with the plan and that they are consistent with your state implementation plan.
And if you have the injury, is it ripe when they haven't yet made the designations, you haven't yet had to start drafting a plan?
Yes. The question here is whether there's a purely legal question, and this court has already said that the question of whether an agency pronouncement is a substantive rule or a policy statement is itself a purely legal question. That can be answered today. This is the consummation of the agency's decision-making process. EPA even decides not to contest that point. It says even if this is the consummation of the agency's decision-making process. And Judge Randolph, in Appalachian Power 1, you wrote that the fact that a law may be altered in the future has nothing to do with whether it's subject to judicial review at the moment. That the ripeness argument, although it's not framed as a ripeness argument, but the what we'll call the ripeness argument raised by EPA is that the agency might change the model at some point in the future. But as this court has held, all laws are subject to change. That does not mean that the case is not right. And I would direct the court to General Electric, the EPA, which makes this point very clearly. They say that particularly for a model that must be updated periodically to reflect advances in science, it would make no sense to hold that it's not right simply because it might change in the future. And in this case, EPA's major revisions to the emissions model have come at 4, 8, and 9 year intervals. So it's very likely that this very model will be in place when the states are required to do.
How are we to evaluate as far as the legally binding or I'm not sure if that's the right way of looking at this, but how are we to evaluate the statutory language that allows a state to propose its alternative model?
Right.
So why couldn't your alternative model be here's the EPA moves 2014, but our alternative model is to tweak it in this fashion, basically prepare an alternative model along the lines of what you would have said in a rulemaking anyway, that it should be changed in this fashion or that fashion?
Well, to step back a moment, Judge Wilkins, this court has said clearly that the possibility of exceptions to a general rule doesn't mean that the law is not binding. So in Alabama Power, the court explicitly considered this argument about whether the potential for the state, for the EPA to accept alternative models might mean that it's merely a policy statement. And the court said no. It's clearly a substantive rule because there's a presumptively required model, and the state has to meet a standard. In that case,
I thought your answer to Judge Wilkins' question, at least what I gathered from your brief, was that the model itself represents the floor, and that anything a state proposes has to be equal to it or great.
That's exactly right, Judge Randolph. In fact, the statute requires that that the state's alternative model be an improved emissions estimating technique. That is, EPA, in its discretion, would have to find that the state's model is better suited to that state's circumstances than EPA's model.
But that doesn't mean that it's a floor in the sense of, you know, there's a predetermined outcome that if you put that in the model, it has to, you know, find at least this amount of a certain pollutant. It means that if it's better at estimating than our model, then you can use it. So
that's
if
exactly.
You can show that your model does a better job of portraying what the real world will be, then the statute says you can use it, right?
Well, Judge Wilkins, I interpret the statute the same way you do, and I think we're in agreement about that. EPA says that if the model is better at doing these estimations than EPA's model, EPA has discretion to allow it. But as a matter of fact, the question, though, is whether in practice, so if we set aside the fact that this language is binding in the official release, and by the way, that should be the beginning and end of the court's analysis, but if we move on to the second prong of the substantive binding rule analysis and look to the agency's actual application, we see that the agency has consistently held its rule to be binding. There's one state, California, that uses its own model, and for Clean Air Act purposes, California is its own country. So it's Sierra Club, which is the case that EPA relies on to prove the alleged flexibility of the model. In that very case, this court repeated EPA's statement that, quote, that EPA, quote, requires that states use the latest model available at the time a is developed, referring to Mobile 6. In that case, EPA's brief said that it requires that any new SIP modeling should be conducted with the new model. And in that brief, it said that its conditional approval of the DC SIP, quote, requires that the state submit a revised attainment demonstration using the Mobile 6 model, the new model at that time. So EPA's practice has been to enforce these models as though they are binding. But again, the court needn't reach that question because the language is clear.
I was also going to ask about your compliance costs argument, because the declarations are a little lacking in specificity about that. Have you already incurred compliance costs, talk about training, new software, as a result of MOVES 2014?
I'm aware of no evidence that we've currently incurred those compliance costs, but those costs are imminent. EPA itself...
How do I know that from these declarations or the record?
Well, EPA, the record, the official release itself that we're challenging, states, EPA states in that release that the states will have to undergo training on the new model. And so the declarations prove that out. They
show
that. Do
they mean all states, or do they mean states that at that time were already in non-attainment?
I think they meant any states that, well, all states that are in non-attainment, because at the time of the official release, no one was using MOVES 2014. And so they're saying that if you're, since you, all you states have been using the old model, MOVES 2010B, you now will have to get training on MOVES 2014. And as you would expect, Kansas, like other states, has modelers in its department who are trained on the then current model, MOVES 2010B. And so our declaration shows that those modelers would have to incur additional expenses, additional training at the taxpayer's expense.
Can you give me in a nutshell how this model is employed or expected to be employed by the states? What exactly do they have to do?
Well, the model
Let me back up a minute. The amount of ethanol that's added to gasoline, is that a state determination or a federal determination?
We're wading into very complicated matters, but that is, I think the short answer is it's a federal determination. The EPA has decided that certain fuels can be used for fuel certification when a vehicle manufacturer builds new cars, and the law says that you're not allowed to sell fuels that are not substantially similar to those fuels. So currently, you're allowed to sell E10, and because of a statutory waiver of that sub-SIM rule, you're also allowed to sell E15. And so that's relevant in this case because Kansas has said that if the model was accurate and demonstrated that ethanol reduces these emissions, we would take steps to encourage the sale of E15, a fuel that's legal already. Which
I thought there was a provision in the Clean Air Act that said that EPA can't dictate the mix of gasoline.
I'm not aware of that provision, Your Honor. It's true that gasoline in different jurisdictions has different components, and states are within limits allowed to set their own standards. But so yes, I think that's right. There's a wide variety in what's in gasoline.
Right.
But the EPA does set certain requirements, and the ethanol limitation is one such requirement.
And overlying this is a Renewable Fuels Act, or whatever the name of it is, requiring a certain percentage to be consist of so-called renewable fuels.
That's right.
Fuels.
And so...
Okay, so I interrupted you, but I just wanted to get that straight. I'm not sure I have. You're right. It's very complicated. But would you tell me how the model fits into this? What do you do with the model? I'm sitting in an office in Topeka, Kansas, or whatever, and I'm trying to figure out what to do with this thing.
Again, this is complicated. But so the model works in a couple of different ways. First, the model generates estimates of emissions effects from the vehicles and fuel in a locality, based on vehicle miles traveled and the available fuels. In theory, this is how it's supposed to work. Those emissions estimates do a couple of things. First, they're fed into air quality models that, one of which was addressed in Alabama Power, which provide estimates of the amount of pollution in the air. And so such models are used to determine whether states are in noncompliance, et cetera. In addition to that, the states have to, and this is what our focus has been on, the states have to use the model to prove up their plan for coming into compliance with the National Ambient Air Quality Standard. So here, Kansas and Nebraska are out of compliance with the 70 parts per billion ozone standard, and they have to show EPA in a state implementation plan how they plan to get to that, to reach that level.
So if theoretically the more ethanol, the less of the six pollutants are emitted, then the state would say, well, one way we can do it is just increase the ethanol percentage.
That's exactly right, and that's you'll find that in our declarations.
Yeah.
And so the states would be using the MOVES model to demonstrate how their plan achieves that.
And the converse, if the model showed that the more ethanol, the more pollutants, then the state would be in compliance by, or try to reach compliance by reducing the ethanol.
And that's precisely the problem we're confronted with here, because the current model, contrary to science, would indicate that increasing ethanol increases pollution. That's just not right. I mean, you can look at the Anderson study that we cite. The first footnotes in that study show 15 or so studies that give results that are the opposite of the results estimated here. EPA also argues that this rule is a policy statement because it merely implements a pre-existing regulatory scheme. But this court's rejected that argument in McCluth, and I'd be happy to answer questions about that.
I'm trying to understand. There's very little discussion of E85 in the briefs. Am I correct that E85 gasoline, that's 85% ethanol?
That's correct. Actually, it's about 51 to 81% ethanol for reasons that are beyond me. But, yes.
But it's called the E85.
That's right.
Okay. Is it created by the splash blending or the match blending?
That's a good question. I'm not sure I can give you an authoritative answer to that. But in practice, at least for E15, the general practice is for E15 to be created by just adding more ethanol to E10 and the blend stock on which the E10 is based. E85 is different, and I'm not sure that it's even produced at the refineries every time. Sometimes in corn-growing states, I think the fuel is blended at the ethanol plants with the addition of gasoline. So you're splash blending, in effect, gasoline into ethanol. But I'm not an expert on that.
Well, I guess the reason I'm trying to get to this is that, you know, I don't know how many cars out there or trucks use E85, but it is, you know, a fuel that's available, and there are cars that burn it. And if indeed it's created by the match blending as opposed to the splash blending, and if the government is supposed to, you know, look at the effect of ethanol throughout a range of this full range, then doesn't that undermine your argument quite a bit that this model relies too heavily on match blending instead of splash blending?
Well, there are a couple of questions wrapped up here. E85 is not something we focused on because E85 is not sold in great quantities, but the science would bear out the same effects that we've demonstrated, that higher levels of ethanol tend to reduce the emissions of these pollutants, especially volatile organic compounds and nitrous oxides, which produce ozone. But here, and match blending, again, is complicated. Our complaint with the EPACT study on which the model is based isn't that all match blending is necessarily defective. The problem is that in this match blending that EPA undertook, they selected an arbitrary set of parameters that produced results contrary to logic. So when there is, you could say that match blending happens in actual practice. That is, refineries, so for example, when gasoline went from E0, gasoline with no ethanol, to E10, you could say that match blending happened because the refineries lowered the octane of the blend stock. That is, they took advantage of the high octane value of ethanol that was going to be added to that fuel. So that's a form of match blending, because they're changing one parameter to make up for the addition of another fuel component. The problem is that in the EPACT study, EPA didn't match blend for octane, the one parameter that refiners do match blend for. Instead, they selected only two points on the distillation curve, that is the curve of temperatures at which various percentages of the fuel distill, leaving out an important bump in the middle so that ethanol was blamed for the emissions effects of other components that were added to artificially and arbitrarily match these arbitrary parameters. These are all technical issues that should be addressed in the agency, and that is why notice and comment is required here. The court noted in Alabama Power that especially for complex scientific models like this, notice and comment is especially important.
It's not under the EPA, though, or the APA, the notice and comment requirement, right?
We'd say that the notice and comment requirement of the APA does apply here.
The APA notice and comment provision is specifically excluded under the Clean Air Act. It's section 7602.
So
it's whatever it is, it's coming from the Clean Air Act, not from the APA.
It's true, Your Honor, that the court has often elided the APA.
There are cases here talking about the APA, I know, but the APA doesn't apply. 553 through 557 don't apply to the Clean Air Act.
Well, if that is so, Your Honor, I would point the court to the cases you've mentioned, which do apply APA notice and comment standards, at least by analogy, if not explicitly.
It's 7607, and it says that provisions of Section 553 through 557 and the judicial review provision of Title V shall not, except as expressly provided here, apply to actions which is to which it applies. So, you know, what we're really doing is interpreting. Maybe we'll borrow from the APA.
I think that's exactly right.
There's some subtle differences, though, in the language.
That may be, Judge Randolph. I would point out that EPA in this case has not argued that there's any distinction at all between the notice and comment requirement of
that's
the
true.
APA.
Yeah.
And the Clean Air Act.
Yeah, that's true.
So, and the cases that we're citing apply them as if they're interchangeable.
Yeah. You mentioned octane. I read someplace, I don't know whether this is common, but in one of the states that the premium gasoline doesn't have ethanol in it. Is that true?
Or
it depends
on
the state?
Not as a rule. So it is possible to buy gasoline with no ethanol in some places.
Yeah. And you're talking about motor vehicles, but, you know, for reasons that should be obvious, I was using my neighbor's snowblower recently, and there's a big warning on it says, do not use gasoline with more than a 10% ethanol content. And what's the reason for that?
Well, ethanol has been shown to have harmful effects on some of those small engines, lawnmower engines, weed whacker, snowblower engines. And so that's why the pumps are clearly labeled with...
You can get non-ethanol gasoline?
Yes, you can.
Oh, yeah.
I couldn't tell you where the nearest station is, but...
To Bethesda? Yeah, file something for me, will you?
No further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Judge Millett.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. it's lunchtime. And may it please the Court, Justin Heminger from the Department of Justice on behalf of Respondent EPA. And with me at council table is Susmita Dubey from EPA's Office of General Counsel. I'd like to make two basic points today, and that is I'd like to first respond to the Court's questions about standing. And then second, I'd like to explain why, even if the states had standing, the notice and the model are not final agency actions that are subject to judicial review under 307D of the Clean Air Act.
Before you do that, can I just make crystal clear on one thing? I take it there's now MOOS 2014A?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Is it your position there's absolutely no material change for purposes of this case between 2014A and 2014?
Not a material change, Your Honor. And so we're not taking the position that this case is moot in some way because of the release of the new model.
There's a big world between moot and effective, so is there any impact from those changes to the analysis of the issues before us?
No, Your Honor. I did want to make one thing clear before making those two points, and that is that our position is not that the states can never challenge the model. We're not here asking the Court to insulate the model from judicial review. Our point is that this is not the proper time and circumstances for this case to be brought.
What is the proper time?
Well, Your Honor, we think there are several different avenues that Congress has established, and I believe it was Judge Wilkins that identified one of them. It's Section 7502C8 of the Clean Air Act. And I'm jumping ahead to the final agency action part of this, but in fact, these two parts of our argument fit together. If the states are eventually found to have areas that are designated in non-attainment, and I want to be clear, that hasn't happened as of today.
Is there any dispute? I know you haven't done the paperwork and you haven't done the designation, but is there any dispute that they are or will be found to be in non-attainment within your, was it 2-year window for making that designation?
I think we wouldn't agree that it's clear that the states are going to be found to be in non-attainment, and that goes to imminency.
How could it not be clear if their monitors are reporting levels that 70 parts per billion or whatever it was that violate the new standards? How could they not be found to be in non-attainment? Well, at least some portions of their states.
Well, I think one answer is non-attainment designations are done by a 3-year trailing monitoring period. Mm-hmm. EPA is going to make these designations it's projected to make the designations in October of 2017. Mm-hmm. And so you're referring to the Brunetti Declaration from the state of Kansas. Mm-hmm. In that declaration, the monitoring years that are identified are 2012 through 2014. So it's not clear which years will in fact be used for monitoring. Levels change over time, and so I don't think today that you can definitively say Kansas will be found to have non-attainment areas by EPA. That's also a separate administrative or agency action that EPA is going to conduct.
EPA makes a determination of non-attainment, and the state can then seek judicial review of that? Is that your point?
That's part of it, but we're not even at that point, Judge Randolph.
Let me pose a problem that I don't know the solution to. Those actions have to be brought within the geographical territory of the affected area, which would be Kansas and whatever that circuit court is, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. There's a provision in the Clean Air Act that requires that any agency action that has nationwide impact and effect has to be brought exclusively in the D.C. Circuit. And there's no question that this model has nationwide impact. So how can it be that each individual circuit will get review of the validity of it? I mean, the reason for that provision in the Clean Air Act is Congress didn't want conflicts all over the place of nationwide determinations by EPA. So how do you square that system that you're describing with the statute that requires exclusive jurisdiction in this circuit?
Well, I think this is something that's in the agency's hands, and that's the point of McCluth. If EPA had said, we're issuing this model as a rule, you have to use the model, here's the notice and comment period, bring your challenge to it within 60 days, then yes, we would agree that challenge would belong here in this court. But EPA didn't choose that path. What EPA said is the model is a policy. We're not making it a rule. And so that
but
does...
But under the judicial review provision of the Clean Air Act, and put aside the APA, it says any final... If this is a final action, let's assume that. If any final action with nationwide impact has to be brought exclusively in the D.C. Circuit. Now, I'm quoting. It's final action of the administrator.
Right, but
it has to be brought in the D.C. Circuit. So you go to another circuit in an enforcement action or a review of a non-attainment determination, and the Eighth Circuit says, no, we can't hear this because that's the D.C. Circuit's jurisdiction.
Well, that would be if it is a final agency action. We've said here that this model is not, in fact, a final agency action. It's only when the model is applied in the context of an individual regulatory action. And that, and the example that I was using is 7502C8, where a state has submitted a non-attainment state implementation plan. And in doing that, they've chosen to use EPA's model. And let's say that one of these states brings their challenge in the context of that state implementation plan and says, we disagree, this isn't the best model. We want to tweak your model and explain why it's different. In that context, that would be a final, if EPA disagreed, that would be a final agency action, that would be the proper time for that state to bring the challenge. And we acknowledge that could end up being reviewed in another circuit, but that, in fact, is one of the consequences of the agency's choice to issue this model as as policy guidance and not as a rule. So we acknowledge, and the petitioners bring this up in their reply brief, that there are some efficiency interests in EPA promulgating the model pursuant to notice and comment rulemaking. In this case, EPA has chosen a different path because there are other interests, countervailing interests, that make a flexible policy a better choice, both for EPA and, more importantly, for the regulated community. And so what that means is that, yes, the model is open to attack, and EPA has to defend the model in an individual agency action. I did want to turn back to standing.
When you talk about flexibility as a policy, do you mean by that the ability of a state to come forward with its own alternative plan? Alternative model?
It's both, Judge Millett. So a state can submit its own model. Mm-hmm. The models are expensive to develop and mm-hmm. Maintain, mm-hmm. But it also could challenge particular facets of EPA's model. And EPA would be open to that in the context of whatever that individual agency action is. And
what do you mean by they could challenge it? Just once they're found in non-attainment, they would say, we shouldn't be found in non-attainment? Or I don't know what you mean by that.
Well, I think that goes to standing, because in fact, maybe this wouldn't make a difference. But if they wanted to challenge the model, and in fact, they're in non-attainment, and as part of that, they felt like it was going to affect their bottom line ability to reach attainment or to implement a particular policy, which I think is still uncertain given the time frame and all the moving parts that have to happen. But if at that point, that would be the time for them to submit the evidence, the extra record material that they've put in the record here, and to make this point to the agency.
How would they do that? Let's suppose Kansas says, okay, we've looked at this new Department of Transportation study, and this model is just wrong. We're raising our ethanol requirement to 15%, and now we'll employ the model, and the model shows that that's going to increase the nitrogen oxide or the sulfur dioxide or CO2. Now what happens? Does the EPA come back and say, well, wait a minute, now you can't change the model, you used it. If you had an alternative, you should have used that. So you've waived any requirement any challenge to the model itself. Is that the way it'll play out?
Well, we would say that the state should bring that challenge to the model in the context of presenting their state implementation plan to EPA, and there's a notice and comment, there are notice and comment procedures that accompany that. So that would be the time for them to say, the model's wrong, you need to change it. And EPA would have to explain why, in fact, the model's right. And we've acknowledged if it's a policy, then, in fact, EPA has to act as if the model hasn't even been issued and has to explain the science and defend the technical merits of its of the fuel effect study and the results that the emissions model produces. And that can happen in that context. There's my understanding is that there are technical documents that accompany the state implementation plans and discuss the modeling. So EPA does look at the way that a particular state is using the model.
But how can a state even draft a plan if it believes that the model is flawed? So, I mean, it just seems, I'm just trying to follow up with Judge Randolph's question. I mean, if Kansas believes that the model is flawed, then they draft a plan and they're like, you know, there's no way we can really reach attainment unless we do these kind of things that are completely unrealistic because this model is unrealistic. So do they have an obligation at that point to present some sort of alternative model? I'm sorry, alternative plan using an alternative model? I mean, I just don't understand how it's supposed to play out at the time that they have an implementation plan that's due, and they have to use some model to do that plan. So they have to create and propose their alternative model at the time that they write their state implementation plan so that they can say, we didn't use your model. We want you to approve our implementation plan using our alternative model. That's the only way that they can really challenge this, is to have created their own model, because otherwise, as Judge Randolph said, they're just kind of using your model but trying to poke holes in it. But that's not really a plan.
So there were a few questions in that, and I'll try to answer each of them. So on the question of what the states can do, there are actually two statutory avenues here. The first is the one that we've been discussing. That's Section 7502C8, which relates to state implementation plans. And the states say, well, we would have to provide our own model. And that's not simply not the case. They could provide their own model, but they also could take EPA's model and do what they've done in this context, which we believe is not the proper context for the scientific back and forth, but explain why they think the model's wrong, what needs to be changed, and then present their modeling inputs and outputs based on that, on those, on what they say is the correct model. And EPA would have to both consider what they've done and also explain why, if it disagreed with that, explain why EPA's version of the modeling is correct. So that's one avenue. The other avenue that we have identified is Section 7430 of the Clean Air Act, which says that any person, and there's no time limit or time reference here, can come to EPA and say, we have improved emission estimating techniques, and we'd like you to consider those.
Right, but so, under either of those scenarios, is there any prospect, any realistic prospect, that either a plan or a model that was based on the premise that ethanol reduces the relevant pollution could be accepted by EPA as long as MOVES 2014 is on the books?
Yes, I think that's an open question.
How?
And, well, because the states haven't done either of the two options that we just discussed.
No, but given the phrasing for the alternative models, and I assume it's the same for plans, is that it has to be at least as good, if not better, than the existing model. That the model provides the operative baseline against which anything they submit is going to be compared. And will have to pass to be accepted. And if their whole point is the baseline is fundamentally flawed, then it's just not a fair game from the start.
Well, I think, Judge Millett, that this court's jurisprudence on models says that a model has to be as close to reality as possible, and that's or approximate reality as closely as it can. And so if their point is that the science shows that EPA's model is flawed and that the more accurate modeling is that ethanol, in fact, improves air quality, then EPA would have to consider that.
But then why do they have to wait?
Well,
why do they have to wait? If they say there's no question they're going to be in non-attainment, and while you've talked about different things, I didn't see anywhere in your brief where you actually answered their declaration's assertion that they will be in non-attainment, again, at least in portions of the states. And so why not get this resolved now before they have to spend a bunch of resources and time fighting it jurisdiction by jurisdiction?
Well, EPA never viewed this as a final agency action. It didn't, you know, the agency did not provide notice and comment rulemaking. So the petitioners have come in with a lot of extra record material and said that the court should consider that. EPA did not consider that material. EPA did consider material.
The position is quite clear that their view is this model is flawed, and yet this model, there's plenty of statutory and regulatory action that says, or language that says, this model is going to be controlling. It will be the baseline for comparisons. You're going to have to prove to us that you meet this baseline or exceed it to have any way to get out of it. Otherwise, it will be mandatory for you to use going forward.
We don't think they've shown that they imminently have to use the model. We don't think they've shown an injury in fact. And the Brunetti Declaration is the closest that they've come. But these declarations, again, if we're looking at standing, we're supposed to go back to when the petition is filed. And at the time the petition was filed, EPA had issued a proposed NAAQS standard for ozone. It had not finalized that rule. And as we stand here today, EPA has still not made non-attainment designations. They say for the 2012 to 2014 monitoring season, we are in non-compliance, therefore we will be designated. I think that's speculative and it's too remote.
Did you submit any declaration that said that they wouldn't be, or that there's any substantial risk they won't be found in non-attainment? There's only, 10 days or 2 weeks, just a short time between the petition and the issuance of at least the proposed ozone regulations, correct?
That was the proposed rule,
Right.
And so our point is, what they're trying to do is reach through two separate rulemakings, two separate final agency actions, and assume that those have taken place, and that then they will have to use the model. And we don't think that that's imminent. We don't think that that's that you can assume that.
What if they filed this petition today?
The non-attainment designations, the earliest that they will be made, my understanding is October of 2017.
Mm-hmm.
So we're still over a year away.
And do states all just sit, are they supposed to just sit passively and do absolutely nothing with respect to MOVES 2014 until they actually get notice from EPA that they are in non-attainment? Or is it expected, at least it's suggested, that they're already providing data to the EPA for purposes of the MOVES 2014 operation, and that they, you know, you had the whole reason you said you were having this two-year grace period is you're expecting states to start learning it and applying it and start using it. So that seems a little inconsistent with saying nothing's going to happen for 2 years or a year and a half.
Well, I wasn't sure what my colleague was referring to. It was apparently in our brief and mm-hmm. references data that we are requiring the states to submit now. I'm not sure what that refers to.
What about your grace period that you're having? This two-year period is sufficient time for state and local agencies to learn and apply new technical guidance and training courses that reflect MOVES 2014. That's what's going on right now during this grace period.
Sure, but again, that applies to states that have to use the model. These states don't have to use the model. They make there's, I believe, one sentence in Mr. Brunetti's declaration that references that they will need to do transportation conformity analysis if they're in moderate non-attainment.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not in moderate, they have not been found to be in moderate non-attainment.
So what about our probability of harm cases for standing?
Well, are you're arguing this is finality or is standing? I'm trying to understand what your point
is. We're arguing both. We're arguing that this case should not be brought because petitioners lack standing and because there is no final agency action for the court to review. Both of those problems go away if, in fact, these states ultimately in a year, 2 years, or more have to use this model in a non-attainment SIP, if they do. And we disagree that it's clear that they have to do that. And our point on imminency is that if you're claiming a future injury, then, in fact, you face a more rigorous burden. We don't think that...
What do you do? I asked this in the last case. What do you do with Massachusetts versus EPA, where the injury was projected to be 50 years from now? Well, the injury to the shoreline because of the rising sea levels and all that, and climate change.
Well, we've pointed out, Judge Randolph, why we think the states here are entitled to special solicitude with respect to one of their five standing theories, and they had invoked Massachusetts VPA. But imminence is alive and well in this court and the Supreme Court, and we think that there's simply too many steps between...
In the Massachusetts versus EPA?
I'm not sure, Your Honor.
I'm not either.
What the states are doing is they're saying, assume as of December 2014 that EPA is going to issue a final NAAQS standard. Assume then that within 2 years after that, EPA will designate us as non-attainment.
Well, which of those assumptions is not 100% certain to happen? I mean, you will have to issue the final NAAQS within, what, a year and a half from now?
No, the final standard
I'm
has
sorry,
issued.
Final, I'm sorry, the it final has,
the non-attainment designations.
I'm sorry.
That's correct.
That those will be due... You said 2017?
October 2017.
So that's certain to happen.
It is.
Okay. And
But
your point is it's not certain that any portion of Kansas or Nebraska will be in non-attainment.
That's correct.
How uncertain is it?
I think it's the state's burden to demonstrate that it's likely to happen.
They've come in. They've said, done. We're going to be in violation of it. They come in and said we're going to be in violation of it. Look at these are numbers that there's just no way we're going to be able to meet. I guess I didn't read it, and they can clarify is, you know, on this day we were in non-attainment, or even this month we were in non-attainment, but simply that these new ozone regulations, and it may just be the nature of science nowadays, are at a level that they're not going to meet. And you didn't come back with any declaration that I saw or evidence that they were wrong about that sort of factual statement. I understand there's been no formal designation. You haven't even picked the 3 years, but assuming that those 3 years are going to involve, you know, be with either 3 years before the final regulation or include some of this 2 year period, if their position is there's just no way we can meet those standards, whatever 3 years you use, what would be uncertain about their designation as non-attained, as in non-attainment?
Well, my point on the modern years is that, in fact, it would be that it's possible that the modern years will, in fact, be years that have not occurred yet. And so for them to say that they are in non-attainment in 2017 based on data from 2012 to 2014 skips a step.
Wait, isn't it usually a multi-year?
It is. So I believe it's a three-year trailing, mm-hmm. But I'm not sure what those years are.
But it couldn't. I mean, could it be entirely prospective, or is the farthest out it could be 15, 16, 17?
That would be the furthest.
Right. So right. If they know they're in non-attainment in 15, and they simply say there's these standards, there's because of the standards, that's not going to change.
Ozone
At
levels.
That point, does a burden shift to you to counter that standing assertion, that factual assertion for standing purposes?
Sure. I mean, all I can say is that ozone levels change year by year, and so they're assuming that they will be found in non-attainment, mm-hmm. and EPA certainly has not made that determination. Mm-hmm. And what they're saying is, but I think you can take it a step further, and we pointed out in our brief that the states have five separate standing theories, but all of them begin with the assumption that, in fact, they are in non-attainment. So we think that that's a facial defect, a flaw in all five theories.
Well, that's not really clear. I thought their compliance costs one did not, because they have to provide data already, it sounds like, and then if they think, rightly or wrongly, that they're going to be in non-attainment, I assume you would think it's wise for agencies, you'd like them to start now getting ready to apply moves if they think it's going to apply to them rather than waiting.
So the compliance costs, the declarations, to my knowledge, do not refer to this requirement that I was not aware of to provide data to EPA. Mm-hmm. The compliance costs that they're referring to is, in fact, training that they say that their modelers will use or will need in order to learn how to use this model as opposed to a different model.
Well, EPA says that, too. That's
correct, but these are presumably salaried employees of the states, and they're, in fact, Kansas has two employees that do these this modeling, and so...
Who has two?
Kansas. The state of Kansas has two modelers that whose job is to do this modeling. And so when they're saying compliance costs, what they seem to be saying is that these modelers will need to get additional training. And that training for experienced modelers to move from MOVES 2010B to MOVES 2014, EPA has developed a webinar that it provides on the through the internet that's the extent of the training that they'll need. So in terms of an actual injury to the states, if these are salaried employees, they're just doing their job. So that's the compliance cost that they're talking about.
On the question of finality, the final decision, does it? Do you think it matters that there's a built-in impetus for EPA not to be changing these models year to year because the states are relying on them and gearing up and doing all their whatever they do, so on and so forth. So EPA wants to give at least some permanence to the model and not keep revising and revising and revising. I mean, it would seem to me that the state administrators would pull their hair out, because they've just spent however much time it takes to figure out their implementation plan, and then the EPA pulls a rug out from under them.
Judge Randolph, we think that there's a real tension there, and we think that that's why ultimately EPA has chosen to treat this particular model as a flexible policy and not as a rule. EPA is trying to balance the need for states to have some models they can use with the fact that the technical, scientific, and even EPA's own rules are constantly changing on these issues. To give an example, EPA has, in this model, implemented a recent vehicle, the Tier 3 regulations, lowering the standard for emissions of pollutants from vehicles. And so states actually, in the state of Maryland, we've included an example in the record, where the state of Maryland said, please finalize the MOVES 2014 model as soon as possible so that we can go ahead and take advantage of the decreases in emissions that this model will show. So that happens on a rolling basis. And the Sierra Club, we cited the Sierra Club case because EPA does its best to work with the states and give some lead time, some flexibility with when the states need to begin to use a new model and when they can use EPA's old version of the model. Mm-hmm. And so there's an attempt by EPA to to go out of its way to make this a flexible process. And we think that benefits the states as much as it benefits EPA to be able to make these changes. And the example I'm way over my time, so I don't want to. The example our Rule 28J letter, as we pointed out in MOVES 2014, EPA made approximately 13 more changes to the model from the MOVES 2014 model. And some of those are correct errors, some of those are to make efficiency improvements to the model. And so we think that that's a good thing, and it benefits the user community as well as EPA.
And your argument is that if you had to go through notice and comment rulemaking to go from 2014 to 2014A, you wouldn't, it would take you a couple years to make every little change, right?
It will certainly chill EPA's flexible process. EPA communicates with the user community. There's examples that we've cited to in the record of them communicating with representatives of these petitioners about the fuel effect study and about their technical objections. But that's an ongoing process, and if we're doing notice and comment rulemaking, then EPA can't issue MOVES 2014A until it's done what's required by the APA.
And I guess your point is, too, that any time you find some flaw or some new scientific evidence and you want to change it, that if it's a rule, you're going to have to go through notice and comment rulemaking to even make a minor amendment on it.
That's correct, Judge Randolph. And in the petitioners in their reply brief say, try to distinguish between major revisions to the model and minor revisions. But the APA is an on and off switch. It's not, this is a technical amendment to the rule, and this is a true substantive change to the rule. In fact,
but
if an agency...
Clean Air Act allow a more flexible approach to notice and comment than the APA might?
So, Judge Millett, that's a good question. I think it ties into Judge Randolph's question to my colleague. And we don't think that this falls under the Clean Air Act's judicial review provisions or standard in Section 7607D that Judge Randolph was asking about. We think that this is an agency action that would be governed by the APA, just as a general matter. So,
you think this is covered? Okay.
So I'm not
sure I follow that. If it's not within, was it 7207?
7607D.
7607, yeah. If it's not within that, and 706 doesn't apply of the APA unless specifically stated, then it's not subject to judicial review under any, not the APA. I think that's where your argument leads. Let me ask you, under what provisions of the Clean Air Act was this model formulated?
It's Section 7430, and that's the provision we've cited to the legislative history from, it was enacted in 1990, and we've cited to the legislative history of the Clean Air Act amendments there for that, yeah. Because...
7430.
Section 7430, Your Honor.
Okay.
And that was in connection with a congressional inquiry. At that time, EPA stated very clearly that it treated the vehicle emissions model as a flexible policy and not as a rule. And so it was open to challenge in an individual agency action. And that was the position the agency took decades ago, and that's the position that it's taking here today.
Right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Gustafson, we'll give you, I think, 2 minutes for rebuttal. Can you focus on the standing concerns about whether or not you actually will be found in non-attainment?
Yes, Your Honor. As you pointed out, EPA has pointed to no evidence to contradict the declarations in this case, which say that, in the opinion of the Director of Air Quality in Kansas's Department of Environment and Health, that the states will be in non-attainment. That's uncontradicted. And so there's no basis for this court to credit the possibility that...
Wait, it says you were using data from 2012 to 2014 in the Brunetti Declaration.
Yes, Your Honor, but there's nothing to indicate that there's less
traffic
now. I don't
see the burdens
on you
now, so now where do you indicate that... whatever years are chosen, we're going to be found in non-attainment.
Well, all we have to show here is a substantial likelihood. And there's no reason to think that there's going to be less pollution in the air tomorrow than there is today.
Well, you just said ozone levels change all the time.
Ozone levels change in response to traffic and in response to industry.
And climate.
And
temperature.
That's true, too. So ozone levels could rise because of climate change.
Right.
But there's nothing to indicate that ozone levels will go down by themselves. That's why EPA has established this National Ambient Air Quality Standard.
And what do you have to say about compliance costs? Is it just a webinar?
This is the first time I've heard about a webinar. Mm-hmm. The official release states that that employees who use these models will have to get training. And the declarations that we submitted state that that training will cost money. And that's sufficient under CELCO. Those sorts of compliance costs.
Because you haven't shown us when you're actually going to incur those costs.
I don't know precisely when, but as you pointed out, those costs.
Would you do it before a formal finding of non-attainment, or would you wait until they actually find that some portion of Kansas or Nebraska is in non-attainment before doing that?
Well, as I pointed out, the states actually will have to use the model because they have to give their inputs.
But that's nowhere in a declaration. It sounds like that, or if you can tell me where that's in the record that you already talked
well,
about that.
Well, in EPA's brief on page 56, they cite 80 Fed Reg 8787. That rulemaking promulgated 40 CFR 51.15, which requires the states to provide their model inputs to EPA. And so that happens now, but
I'm sorry, where? Sorry.
So page 56 of EPA's.
But do we know that those are inputs from states that are already in non-attainment, or from all 50 states, regardless of status?
Well, it's for the purpose of EPA building its national emissions inventory, and I don't think it distinguishes between attainment and non-attainment states. But our standing case is resting.
But you're not certain. I mean, if this is your sort of key.
This
standing,
is not our standing case, Your Honor. We've made.
You don't want us to rely on this as a compliance cost injury for standing purposes.
We think that adds to what we've already proven, but the.
If we thought it was important, do you know that you have actually already had to provide inputs, or will imminently, as a state that has not yet been designated?
I do not know the answer to that.
Is it true that Kansas has only two modelers that will be affected by this?
That's what the declaration says.
Yeah.
But to distinguish this case from Mass v. EPA, regardless of the court's opinion about Massachusetts v. EPA, this is a case in which the states themselves are suffering a regulatory injury. The model will make it harder for them to comply with the ambient air quality standards. This
only if you're found to be in non-attainment.
That's right. And there's nothing to contradict our statements that we will be in non-attainment.
What's the harm to you from not waiting and challenging it in the format that they propose?
Your Honor, the EPA today suggests that there may be some way for us to challenge moves without putting forward an alternative model of our own. But when I listen to the description, it sounds a whole lot like putting together an alternative model. And in fact, there
no,
is
I thought
no.
They said, I thought they said, in, obviously you could do the model thing, but the other thing you could do is come forward with a state implementation plan, and your state implementation plan would explain, here's how this is going to get us in compliance. Now, we know under MOVES you're going to think this doesn't get us in compliance, but that's because MOVES is wrong for A, B, C, and D reasons. And when you fix that, such as our use of ethanol will actually get us in non-attainment sooner, I'm sorry, in attainment sooner, but you can actually do it through the format of pressing for acceptance of your SIP, and if they reject it, then you'll have a challenge.
Well, that is what Mr. Heminger said, and that would be great, but that's not what the statute actually allows.
But
the statute allows alternative models when they are improvements on the existing model.
Mm-hmm.
And but EPA in this very case.
So
you don't
want to take them up on the offer?
No, Your Honor, that would not satisfy the states because this model, for example, took 10 years. The underlying study took 10 years to do. The states are not in a position to do a rival study.
No,
like
I understand that.
That.
I'm really focused on whether you can challenge this through your state implementation plan.
We don't think that's plausible because the EPA has already said that it's doubled down on its reliance on this model and on the very emissions factors that we're complaining about. So we say that these factors are based on match blending of parameters that real refiners don't match blend and that the results are wrong. EPA says the results are right. If we're in a SIP scenario where we put together a non-conforming SIP and say, EPA, we think you should accept this anyway because your model is flawed, this very case demonstrates exactly why EPA would say no.
What's the percentage? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And we'd be directly injured there because the penalty for that is a federal implementation.
But couldn't you then bring the same actions, challenging their denial of your estate implementation plan. Is there a mechanism for doing that?
We would have to, well, so this is what would play out. First, EPA would propose to deny our state implementation plan. We would file comments on the proposed denial of the implementation plan, you know, laying out the reasons why we think the model is wrong, and under the law, showing why our model is right. Of course, we don't have a model. And then EPA would finalize its disapproval of the SIP, and then we would go into court. And as Judge Randolph pointed out, it wouldn't be this court, even though the model we're challenging here is one of nationwide
capability. Would you be forbidden to bring that challenge here? Would you have to bring that in the Eighth Circuit? Or could you file? Would you have a choice?
Your Honor, I think it's very unlikely that the courts would hold that.
I think the statute requires you to bring it in the Eighth Circuit.
Even if it has the national implications?
I think that's right. And I think EPA would say this is a local implementation plan.
What is the percentage of ethanol required or used in Nebraska and Kansas now?
Well, there's E10 available, and in some places, but not universally, you can get E15. That's the minority fuel. And in some cases, there's E85 as well. Okay. But E10 is, by and large, the predominant fuel in use.
And your point on the non-attainment, I just want to be clear about this, is that if you apply this model to E10, that you'll be in non-attainment?
So our complaint about the model is that it says that if the state were to switch to E15, that pollution would go up instead of going down, as would actually happen. So the states are constrained in their policy choices. They'd like to encourage E15 use through tax incentives or other mechanisms, and they're not able to do that because under the model, that would actually increase pollution.
Okay.
No one is saying that minor error corrections would need to go through notice and comment. We didn't make up the terms major and minor. These are the terms that EPA has applied to its models, and they have not denied that this one, MOVES 2014, is a major revision to the prior model.
But the revisions that have been done in the past were not promulgated through formal notice and comment.
Well, that's in dispute, Your Honor. We've actually...
How is that in dispute? Show me in the record where they've said this is a formal rulemaking.
EPA has issued these models through advance notice in the Federal Register, and then it's often inviting public comment and workshops. These are all in our briefs. And it has finalized the models through what it calls a notice of availability. Although it's not denominated.
That's what it did here.
It did not do that here. So there was no prior notice. All EPA did was issue a final rule in the form of a notice of availability with no prior notice, no invitation to comment, no public workshop. And EPA says that those old notices, advance notices, did not adequately satisfy notice and comment. I was puzzled to hear that. EPA has taken contrary positions in the past. Judge Millett, in the first EPA decision that you wrote, another Sierra Club case, EPA took the position that notices of data availability could satisfy the notice requirement. And there's the West Virginia case that we cite is an example of a notice of data availability satisfying the requirement for notice and comment. So I don't see any reason to distinguish a notice of the advance notices in this case.
Well, notice is only part of it, right? Notice and comment requires an agency to do, you know, certain things, to get comments and then to respond to those comments and then to explain their rationale. Right?
That's
only the first step. I guess what I'm saying is, where do I see in the record that they've always followed all of those steps
with
these prior promulgations?
We show that with regard to, I don't know that it's always clear exactly how many comments they received and responded to. It is clear for at least one of the models, and it might be Mobile 6, I'm not sure. EPA notes that they received 15 sets of comments and that they modified the model in response to it. That sounds like notice and comment to me. In this court's decision in Environmental Defense Incorporated, the court assumed that models like this, MOVES 6.2 in that case, would have to go through notice and comment if they were applied in a new context. In that case, hotspot analysis for a particulate matter. And the court noted that EPA had satisfied that requirement, specifically by accepting comment on the appropriateness of Mobile 6.2 and explaining why it was inappropriate to use Mobile 6.2 in this context. So I think EPA has, in fact, used notice and comment here. But even if there were some technical flaw in its past notice and comment, the agency's past failures do not excuse its current failures, current procedural failures. On the legislative history of 7430, we've shown that in that case, EPA was responding to an attack on the adequacy of its notice and comment from American Petroleum Institute and from the Government Accountability Office and Government Accounting Office. And so that's exactly the kind of post hoc rationalization that McCluth says this court is not to consider. There are no further questions.
Thank you. The case will be submitted.